opportunity when you saw the sign up, which Ritz gave me, so that I would have what to say with regard to the introduction. But the I don't need the sign. You saw that Dr. Broyd is a professor of law at Emory University. You saw that he was the academic director of law and religion program at Emory. He's a dayan on the Beit Din of America and is a prolific writer, writing on a whole slew of legal issues, and specifically the interplay between religion and secular law, on anything ranging from military ethics to personal status and aguna issues in particular. Recently an important and somewhat controversial article or series of articles in Tradition with regard to women covering their hair, etc. And the what you didn't see was that which makes this a very special introduction for me, is that we were kavrutot in YU. That Revitz forgot to put on the sign. So it's always a very much a personal pleasure and honor when I'm able to not only introduce people of whom I have a tremendous amount of respect, but people who I can call friends as well. And having said that, I now will give you Professor Rabbi.
No need to stand for me. I know that. We're going to talk today about 9/11 Agunot. But first, before we do that, or in the course of doing that, we need to stop and talk about, in general, DNA evidence in halacha. And to do that, we really need to talk about how to balance statistical evidence from a halachic perspective. So I want to start first and foremost with a Shulchan Aruch that we're going to understand or try to understand, and then we'll go on from there, because it's a very fascinating, interesting Shulchan Aruch. Isha Shahaya Baala B'Medina Tayam V'Shah Hasham Yoter Miyud Beiz Chodesh V'Yalda Achar Yud Beiz Chodesh Havlad Bamzer Shein Avlad Shah B'Mei Imo Yoter Miyud Beiz Chodesh. Husband and wife are married, and the husband goes overseas, and the wife gives birth to a child 13 months after she was last with her husband. The child is a mamzer. How come?
It's another wife.
I'm sorry?
It's impossible.
It's impossible that the husband is the father, and since somebody else must be the father, the child is a mamzer. Makes perfect sense. So I have a question. I have a question. What about the child that gives birth 11 months after the father left? Who's the father of the child according to the Shulchan Aruch? The husband. So I have a question. What's my question?
What are the chances of that?
So the answer is, and this is very important to note, not all pregnancies last 9 months. One in every 10,000 pregnancies last 9.5 months. One in every 200,000 pregnancies last 10 months. One in every 2 million pregnancies lasts 11 months. Okay? There's quite a bit of literature on this. This is not an unusual conversation. About one in every 2 million pregnancies no longer happens nowadays, because now they induce labor. But in the old days, where they didn't induce labor, there were recorded cases that we have no reason to doubt that one in every very infrequent pregnancies lasts 11 months. There's a case in Time magazine in 1945 about such a case. And by the way, this is consistent with studies of animals. Animals are easier to study than people, because you can lock them in a cage. And it turns out that one in every 2 million horses go 2 standard deviations longer than an expected horse pregnancy. And so there's no reason to think that the same thing is not true for a human being. Still, I have a question as a matter of halacha. So this woman gives birth 11 months after she was last with her husband. We have to do a balance. What's the balance? There's a 1 in 2 million statistical likelihood that the husband's the father. Tell me what's the other side. What's the other side? 1.9 million. Tell me though, how do I do the halacha here? How likely is that the husband, the father of this child is not the husband? The answer is very important as a matter of halacha. The answer is that for an Isha Kishera, who you've seen nothing negative about, the probability of the husband being, the father being anybody other than a husband is
zero.
Because you have no reason to doubt her Chezkat Kashrut. And since the likelihood that the father is somebody other than the husband is zero, and we know that every once in a while, no matter how frequent it might be, the father is the 11-month absent husband, halacha looks up and says the father of this child is the husband. Not because, as you would think at first glance, because we don't like labeling people mamzerim, that's also true, but we don't have any problem labeling the child a mamzer after 12 months, notwithstanding our distaste. It's because when you examine statistical evidence, you have to determine not just the statistical likelihood of this event, you have to also determine the statistical likelihood of other explanations that are possible. If the statistical likelihood of this event is 1 in 10,000, and the statistical likelihood of all other events are 0, then you know what? 1 in 10,000 happens sometimes. 0 happens never. And indeed, the Rama makes it clear, because the Rama is living in an even more real world than the Mechaber. The Rama says, Aval toch yud beis chodesh ein lachush. Within 12 months, you should assume that the likelihood that the child is not from the husband is 0. Because we say the fetus stayed in the mother this long. The dafka shelo ra'u ba davar mechur. Avalim ra'u ba davar mechur lo amrin dishtu kol kach b'chashinim lay. Rama says that's only with a person whose conduct is proper. But once I see improper conduct by the woman, I'm not interested right now in discussing what exactly you have to see to ring the bell according to the Rama. But once you see impropriety, then we're no dummies either. Once we see impropriety that leads us to think that maybe there's adultery, then we have to balance the other way. We have a woman who gives birth 11 and a half months after she's been with her husband, and 9 months after she appears to have been with somebody who's not her husband. We're also not dummies. What do we say? We say, well, there's a 1 in a million chance that the husband's the father, and there's a 1 in 17 chance that the other person's the father. I think we'll go with the other person. And the Rama here is laying out for us a very, very, very important theory that becomes central to all sorts of problems relating to agunot. Or at least agunot in which husbands are missing, what we call 9/11 agunot. For years and years, the Beth Din of America dealt with agunot only in the sense of what we call recalcitrant husbands. Husbands and wives that were looking to get divorced, but we knew where the husband was, we knew where the wife was, we just couldn't get the husband to give a get. Then all of a sudden, and we had all assumed socially, and many years ago when we wrote a book on this, we noted in the first chapter that we're using the term agunot in its modern sense, because classical agunot, we said somewhat flippantly, don't happen anymore. Little did we know. It's not true, though. When 9/11 occurred, all of a sudden the Befton of America became inundated with questions involving people who disappeared. People who disappeared. We wrote 15 tshuvot on this topic, and we resolved close to 100 questions that didn't need tshuvot to be formally written, involving people who went to work and disappeared. Let's start with the hardest question first. Man turns to Rabbi Adam Mintz, then the rabbi of the Lincoln Square Synagogue, after the 640 minyan. He's a British tourist. He turns to Rabbi Mintz and says, "I'm stuck here for a whole day. My flight back to Heathrow is at 4 o'clock. What should I do?" You know, rabbis after shul davening, they tell you all sorts of good pieces of advice. Rabbi Mintz says, "I grab a bagel and go to the top of the World Trade Center. Take a look around." And that's it. We know nothing else about the man except what? He never made it back to the UK, and he totally and completely disappeared. That's all we know. He has a wife and kids. He was here on business. His flights to the UK, of course, were canceled. All the flights were canceled for 3 days. But he never made another appearance in the world after that point. He disappeared. Do we know what happened to him? No. We don't know anything. It's hard for us to say with certainty what happened. Somebody want to guess what happened? Help me. He was killed. How was he killed? He grabbed a bagel, like Rabbi Mintz said, took the train, and was standing on the top of the World Trade Tower when the first one and then the second one were hit. And didn't have a working cell phone because the British phones don't work in America, and he died there. I've just totally and completely speculated with you. Could he also have ran off to Bensonhurst, found the love of his life in Italian Bensonhurst, and completely disappeared? Sure. Why don't you think that's likely? Why don't you think that's likely?
Because we witnessed the catastrophic events that happened.
Absolutely, but what? Well, there's no doubt that the World Trade Tower was destroyed. That's not up for conversation.
We know that he was there.
We don't know that he was there.
We would presume that he would try to contact his family, like at least his kids, or his wife to tell them that he was okay or that he's not coming back or something.
So one answer is that happily married people who go off on business trips don't just disappear for no reason. And if he disappeared for no reason, it must be because something bad happened to him. Somebody else?
You probably could see if his family, there was a good marriage.
Do we want to call up the wife and say, "Excuse me, was this a happy marriage, or was the last thing your husband said to you, 'Goodbye, I'm leaving you'?" That's important as well. Maybe we need to inquire as to whether there is shalom bias. Maybe they were unhappily married, and the last thing he said to her before he left for New York from Heathrow Airport was, "Thank God I've got a girlfriend at Bensonhurst." Now, that isn't what he said, of course.
And if he's the kind of person that goes to shul and asks the Rav what to do on his spare day, then we maybe can assume that he's not the kind of person that would just run off and find a woman just because...
Okay, right. From people we hope don't do this. That's another good approach. What else? Anything else? Now, we go through the rubble tightly. The New York State Medical Examiner DNA types... every single remain that's out there, every single remain is DNA typed. About 2/3 of the remains are positively identified to a known victim. His remains are not typed. Does that affect your calculation? Now, many people's remains are not matched. We, to this very day, do not know the names of all the victims. To this very day, notwithstanding the huge amount of money the government spent on this, since the the World Trade Center was a tourist site. There were many people there who were just there because it's the tallest building in New York, and they were going up to tour, and it was their unluck to be there at a very bad time. What other factors do we want to consider? So Rav Elazar Verdun, writing almost 1,000 years ago, says another factor to consider is the passage of time. Rav Elazar Verdun says, look, people disappear sometimes for a few days. He's writing around the year 1150, and they disappear for a few days and we can't find them, and you know what? They pop back in. But Rav Elazar Verdun says, after the passage of a large amount of time, you know what we can assume? That they're dead. The poskim, Rav Elazar Verdun's contemporaries, all reject him. And they say, no, 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 that's not a proper assumption, because people get dragged off by the Crusaders and put in chains and brought to Israel, and they can't call home, and they're stuck in slavery their whole life, but they're not dead. The Truma Sedeshin, writing in the year 1475, 350 years after Rav Elazar Verdun, says, I think that Rav Elazar Verdun was wrong in the year 1100, but the Truma Sedeshin says, look at us now, we're so sophisticated and advanced, we have a postal service, we have a network of communication. People don't just disappear, they can send a letter. And 6 months later, your letter appears through the Pony Express, and people know you're alive. So the Truma Sedeshin says, after the passage of 2 years, we should rely on the view of Rav Elazar Verdun. The Rama rejects that view. The Mechaber so strongly rejects the view that he doesn't even quote it. The Rama quotes it and says it's not right. And the Mechaber gives you the ultimate, you don't count by not even counting you. The Chasam Sofer, who dies in 1848, says Rav Elazar Verdun is wrong because he lived in primitive times. And the Truma Sedeshin, he was wrong because he lived in primitive times. But nowadays, the Chasam Sofer says, you know what we have? The telegraph. And not only do we have the telegraph, we have trains. And if you get lost, you know what happens? You telegraph home, and your family offers to pay for a collect railroad ticket, where they let you on the train for free, and you get home. So we should rely on Rav Elazar Verdun nowadays, since travel is so much more sophisticated in Hungary in 1840. And the poskim reject him. They say Hungary, 1830, not good enough. People still disappear. Rav Moshe Feinstein, writing in 1950, in response to the Holocaust, he gives a number of chidushim. We'll touch on another one in just a few minutes. But he says, Rav Elazar Verdun was wrong, and the Truma Sedeshin was wrong, and the Chasam Sofer was wrong, but nowadays, you know what we have? Telephones. Not only telephones, we have newspapers that get delivered every day. And he says, not only that, the United States government is printing up lists of all survivors and distributing them everywhere so you can check to see anywhere if there's a survivor widely distributed. We should rely on Rav Elazar Verdun. And Rav Nata Greenblatt, a well-known posek in America, wrote to us.
How long did he like, you talk about 2 years.
Six months. Rav Moshe doesn't give you an exact time. He says it depends on how quickly they disperse the DP camps. A very technical issue. The United States government is running displaced persons camps in Europe. We thought only until 1948, but in fact they ran them until 1950. Rav Moshe says when all the DP camps are empty, anybody who's not somewhere can be assumed to be dead.
So how can we learn a rule from there?
So Rav Moshe says the rule is as follows. We nowadays count and accumulate everybody. And after they're finished counting and sorting through everybody in all the DP camps, if you're not in a DP camp, and you're not in Israel being resettled, and you're not in the United States being resettled, you know what you are?
Dead.
And Rav Nata Greenblatt, a Talmud of Rav Moshe, Rav Nata Greenblatt was the first Talmud of the Rav in Heichal. I'm sorry? He learned by the Rav in Boston before there was a Rabbi Soloveitchik at YU, and when the Rav left Boston to go teach at YU, he moved to MTJ and learned with Rav Moshe, and now he lives in Memphis. He's Kenahara, an elderly man. He writes us a tshuva saying that if Rav Moshe was right in 1950, even more so nowadays, where you can't do anything without identifying yourself. It used to be in the old days, if you wanted to hide, you could hide. But nowadays, Rav Nachman says, without showing your passport, your driver's license, your social security number, you can't go anywhere. And it's even more so true, we should rely on Rav Elazar Verdun. So one approach to very hard cases says our world has changed. And when we have no indication that a person hasn't consciously chosen to run away, we can assume when a person's in a place of tragedy, even if we don't know that they perished or not, from the fact that there was a tragedy and then they disappeared, that's enough of a statistical assertion that allows us to claim that they are dead. A second approach, which is, please.
Just curious, from your lawyer, when you're in America, you see on milk containers that they have missing children all the time, and that lasts for years where they're still searching for people.
Right.
So just taking out halakha perspective for a second from the legal police America perspective, don't they relate for a very long time?
Sure. So Rav Nachman's answer is very important. He says that's where there is no tragedy, as opposed to when there is a tragedy. When there is no tragedy means you're just skipping along to school one day and you disappear. Then we don't know what to do. But when you're skipping along the World Trade Center on 9/11 and then you just disappear, we know what happened, or we think we know what happened. There's an obvious distinction between a person who just disappears not in the face of a tragedy and a person who disappears in the face of a tragedy. Rabbi Herzog, by the way, the first chief rabbi of the state, has a famous tshuva involving a man living in Rome who drove home every day over the same bridge at around 4:30 in the afternoon. And one day the bridge collapsed and he disappeared. Can we assume, Rabbi Herzog writes, that what? His car was on the bridge when the bridge collapsed and he died. And Rabbi Herzog says yes, because it's the answer to your question. It's not that you disappear, it's that there's a tragedy.
Even though the rule the other person seemed to be saying was the fact, wasn't reliant on the tragedy. That seems to be an addition here, right? Elazar Verdun, the Jewish tradition, the Chasam Sofer, they're all relying on, the reality is that we can look at the world and we have enough information that we can basically know where everyone is at any given time. Regardless of
truth. No, I think it requires an explanation as well of why the person would have died. I mean, we have to say we assume the person died because X happened. We can't place the person at X, but X is close enough.
We need some evidence to place him at X. I mean, if he's just in New York in that morning.
Now you're asking a great question.
Without Rabbi Mintz, for example.
Right? Without Rabbi Mintz, without Rabbi Mintz, the world would be a less pleasant place in general. But without the assertion that I sent him to the World Trade Center, maybe this case would be a totally different case because we have no presumption that the person was there. But once we have a presumption that a person is there and we know the person disappears, Rav Nata Greenblatt, Rav Moshe Feinstein, both adopt the view that nowadays, after the passage of a small amount of time, that's enough.
Well,
to validate.
Well, Rav Moshe's tshuva is dealing with an Auschwitz.
Auschwitz is...
That's a far greater statistical probability that the person was disappeared there or something happened to him than...
Yes, but Auschwitz... Rav Moshe not only says this for Auschwitz. Auschwitz really has the status of a kibshon shalish. We'll come to that in just a minute. Rav Moshe says you can say this for anybody... who is supposed to be there at the war's end, they're gone. You don't have to show... Rav Moshe holds it's an easy case if you can show they were in Auschwitz. But you can't show they were in Auschwitz. You just... A husband and wife were separated in Poland, and husband was sent to be a laborer, and wife was sent wherever. Wife survives. She's looking for her husband. He's not on any of the lists anywhere if she wants to remarry. Rav Moshe says she can remarry because... Even a German laborer, we can assume either he survived the war or he perished. But he's not living with his girlfriend in Bensonhurst.
Why is Auschwitz considered to be a Kiefschenschel Aish? Because Kiefschenschel Aish is something that everyone who falls into dies.
Right.
People survived Auschwitz.
Right. But so the answer goes as follows. The survivors of Auschwitz were documented. It's not necessary that nobody survived the Kiefschenschel Aish. It's sufficient that anybody who survives the Kiefschenschel Aish is documented. The halachic gezeira of Mayim She'en Lahem Sof goes as follows. We're fearful when people escape and their escape is not being held track of. Once we're keeping track of everybody who escapes, then we can say as follows. If you didn't escape, then what? Then you died. And this is, by the way, another series of Aguna cases. I'll give you the next case. I'll give you two cases that are similar but different.
How many cases do you need to show there are exceptions to that rule? Especially in the Holocaust, I know the statistics, but if you found a case where a person escaped from the camps and decided, you know, forget religion, forget everything, I'm running away from my past, and which I think has happened, people find people that they thought were dead and they are alive because they made mistakes in the list and things like that. At what point do we realize that maybe those lists aren't so accurate or those...
Less than one in a thousand.
What's that?
Less than one in a thousand. Once mistakes start to occur one in a thousand, then you have a bigger problem. That would be my intuitive answer. Mistakes occur everywhere, but a mistake that occurs less than one in a thousand is so rachot that you don't have to pay attention to it. I'll come back to that question in a minute, because Rav Moshe addresses that question with an absolutely novel insight in just a minute. Two 9/11 cases. Above the 89th floor on the North Tower and below the 89th floor on the North Tower. If you were, the plane hit the North Tower on the 89th floor. If you were above the North Tower, nobody escaped. Because the plane hitting the tower destroyed both the elevators and the stairwells, and of all the people we know were on there, not a single person survived, period. That's an easy case of Kiefschenschel Aish. That's analogous to being thrown in a furnace. And once you're thrown in a furnace, then we don't have to know that you died. It's sufficient to show that because you were thrown in a furnace, you know what? You must have died. But the Shulchan Aruch Lamed says, Nafa l'toch kivshon eish, o l'toch yorah rotechet, malei yayin, Hashem en omayin, o sheshachtu bo shnei simanim aruvan, afilo amaru barach, me'idim lav shemei, shevadai sofo lamut. You don't have to see the person dead. It's sufficient to say that we locked him in the furnace and then we lit the furnace. And it's true, when we opened the furnace, you know what we saw? Nothing. No bones, no nothing. We say everything was incinerated, but maybe he poofed himself out magically. So the Rishonim say, in general, we don't operate the system based on the assumption that people are miraculously saved. These types of miracles are outside the framework of the halachic process. Now, below the 89th floor, many, many, many people were saved. The vast majority of people were, in fact, saved. But not everybody. Some people were saved, and then you know what they did? They went back up to help other people. There's a very tragic story involving a member of the Riverdale community who went back up and down five times to help carry people who couldn't get down. And the sixth time he went up and didn't come back because the building collapsed. That's an easy case too, because we can identify that he went up. Once he says, I'm going back up, and the building collapses, then it's easy for us to say what happened. We know he was there and the building collapsed, but I have a question. He went back up because he knew that there were people still up there. What's the status of those people? So here we have another very important halachic rule. When we're closely counting people, and we can make a claim that we know everybody who went in and everybody who went out, anybody who we didn't see go out, you know what we can assume? They were still in. And here, by the way, the Port Authority proved an enormous halachic resource. When you went into the World Trade Center, other than as a tourist, you know what you have to do? You have to be scanned in through your card. You couldn't just walk in. You have to show your card. And when you show your card, we have a record that you went in. And then all we have to do is compare the records of who went in with the records of people who got out. And frequently in these cases, we had additional evidence. What's additional evidence? It's all circumstantial. Husband calls wife and says, a plane hit the towers and I'm trying to leave. It's not simple to get out of here. I love you. And what? Doesn't get out. Halacha says that's enough of an assertion that he must have died, because he's identified himself in the Kiddushan. He's saying to you what? I'm trying to get out, but what? He doesn't get out. That's enough of a statistical identification that we can say with near certainty that this is a person who must have, in fact, died. Now, Rav Moshe presents a novel answer to your question. Rav Moshe says as follows, the Gezeiros Chachamim of Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof, which is, if I don't know if anybody survived or not, Rav Moshe says that Gezeira only applies to individual tragedies. I disappear. You disappear. But Rav Moshe says when there's communal tragedies, we don't apply the Gezeirah of Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof, and we permit people to remarry in any situation in which it's very likely that the spouse is dead, even if we know there's some sort of a survival rate or an error rate. But the rabbinic decree of Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof is limited to individual tragedies and not communal tragedies where many, many, many people died. That's how Rav Moshe addresses your error phenomena. My own view is that Rav Moshe is correct. It's based on a Rabbeinu Yerucham. There are others who don't like it at all and find it a very complicated analysis. But I think that Rav Moshe is aware of your problem. Rav Moshe is saying, gosh, in the case where 6 million people were killed, there's got to be some cases of people who ran away and just changed their identity and got away with it. But Rav Moshe's technical answer is the formal decree of Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof doesn't apply in situations in which large numbers of people perished, rather than situations where just individuals perished, or we're dealing with small, small, small numbers of people. So these kinds of cases return to the forefront of the rabbinic tradition all of a sudden after 9/11, where we're starting to do detailed statistical analysis. And by the way, sometimes you get back a medical report of DNA analysis which is ambiguous. You get back a thigh, and the medical examiner says there's a 99.97 chance that this thigh comes from this person. Can somebody explain that to me in English? What does that mean? What does that mean? A 99.97 chance that this thigh comes from this person.
99.97 out of 1,000.
And so what does that mean, though, in terms of statistical likelihood that it's this person?
It's most likely going to be him.
It's most likely him. How many other Americans are there whose thigh it could be? There are 250 million, there are 300 million American men, okay? And there are 300 million American people. We'll assume for the sake of this conversation that half of them are men. So when I say 3 out of every 10,000 thighs randomly selected matches this person, how many are there?
150.
I'm sorry? 50, that's right. Is that a high number or a low number?
Well,
so tell me how I know that this thigh comes from this person.
The other 50 weren't in the World Trade Center.
This is very important to understand. Statistical evidence standing alone, al pidin, is less important than the combination of statistical evidence plus opportunity. Statistical evidence plus opportunity is very, very, very persuasive as a matter of halacha in ways that statistical evidence without opportunity almost never means anything al pidin. Because until you can show why we're picking this person, even something that's 99.9999% accurate, all that means is one in every 100,000 people matches. One in every 100,000 people matches means in a country of 300 million people, you're talking about thousands of people. What you have to show is this person we think was in the World Trade Center. And since we think he was in the World Trade Center and this thigh is an excellent match for him, what are we going to say? It's him. That's a very important halachic point. This explains, by the way, a certain hesitancy in halacha to rely on pure paternity testing. Pure paternity testing is somewhat unreliable. What do I mean by that? A woman has a child. They don't know who the father is. They take a little bit of DNA from the child. They run a random DNA test through the United States government DNA database. The odds are likely that they will get a match. There are about 20 million people in the United States government DNA database. The odds are pretty good they'll get a match. What does that show you? Nothing. Because when I show you paternity is 99.999% likely, what that means is one in every 10,000 men randomly selected could be the father. One in every 10,000 men randomly selected could be the father means in the United States there are 150 men who could be the father. How do I know which one is the father? How do I know? What other question do I need to ask? I'm sorry?
Opportunity.
Of these 150 randomly scattered men, which one could have been the father practically? That'll help us narrow down which of the 150 men who have been genetically selected. Now, in the last 2 years, we've developed better DNA technology, so sometimes you can get what they call an absolute match. But even absolute matches are pretty rare, and you have to have almost a perfect DNA sample. At the time that we were doing the 9/11 testing, there were almost no absolute matches. What there were was confirmation that this is very likely belonging to this person, combined with scan card information which showed that this person was in the World Trade Center, or this person had scanned his Metro card at 42nd Street onto the A line heading downtown. We discovered that when you scan your Metro card, when you scan your subway scan card, you know what they do? They relate it to the purchase. So if you purchase a subway card with your credit card, and then you use your subway card to get onto the subway, the New York City subway system says, oh, the purchaser of this subway card just got on the subway. You think you have privacy, you have none. That's what it taught us. It was very easy for us to scan all the professionals whose cases we were dealing with to get their credit card information and then to go to the MTA and find out their subway scan cards and when they got on the subway. And this becomes part of the evidence, which is you got on the subway at Port Authority at 8:07 and you disappeared, that's an indication that you were killed in 9/11, because that was the train that was under the World Trade Center when it collapsed. There was a train that was there. That train, nobody on the train survived, and we know which train it is, and we know when it pulled out of Port Authority, and if you were on the train, you didn't survive. These kinds of evidence goes very, very far to resolving contemporary Aguna cases. Please.
What's to say that somebody didn't get off 2004?
There's nothing to say for sure. All that this does is it facilitates the identification of a person in a way that makes it sufficiently accurate. When you combine it with no marital discord, no sightings of the person, no attempt by this person to contact us, and their office was located in the World Trade Center, that sounds like it's enough. But you should know the system is not 100% accurate. In 1982, an Israeli tankist by the name of Shai Held was taken hostage in the same time that Zach Bauman was taken hostage. Zach Bauman and I went to elementary school together many years ago in a different life. We used to play football in the playground of the Hebrew Academy of Long Beach. And Shai Held was taken prisoner as well. And the Rabbanut declared him dead based on a collection of statistical evidence. And 2 years later, he came back after hiding out in southern Lebanon for 2 years in a set of heroic activities. But the answer goes as follows. Wartime is intrinsically more complicated, and the halachic practice is, as Rav Moshe notes, in a wartime setting, you don't permit any agunot until the war is over. Because until the war is over, you run the risk of enormous, enormous tragedy, because in the fog of war, it's just very difficult to determine the truth. Can you pass me that reading?
Was it Ron Arad declared dead?
I'm sorry?
Ron Arad.
Ron Arad was declared dead as well.
Not by the Israeli government, though. I think only by the Israeli rabbinate.
I don't know. Rabbi Avadi Yosef is the person who wrote the Tshuva declaring Shai Held dead as well. And that's itself a meaning. You have to recognize that sometimes things go wrong. I'm going to quote you a story from somebody rarely quoted in a Beis Medrash. This is from Jimmy Carter's autobiography of his childhood. He's a rarely quoted person. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, my uncle Tom Gordy and about 30 other sailors were stationed in Guam. Tom and the others were captured about a month after the war began and taken to Japan as prisoner. Tom's wife, Dorothy, and their three children left San Francisco and came to Georgia to stay with my grandparents. In the summer of 1943, the International Red Cross notified Dorothy officially that Tom was dead. She began receiving a widow's pension, and for a year or so, she married a friend of the family who had a stable job and promised to care for her and her children. 2 years later, when the war ended and American troops entered Japan, they found Tom Gordy still alive. Tom wrote to me about his situation and said he still loved his wife and children and wanted to be with them. Dorothy quickly decided to have her second marriage in old, but Tom was very weak and unable to resist his mother and sisters, who convinced him that Dorothy betrayed him for adultery while he was a prisoner of war. He got a divorce. It's a very moving, complex story. And Halacha is very afraid of this story. And because Halacha is very afraid of this story, it's a true story. I have reason to think that maybe Carter is a liar, but not about matters like this. I mean, this is a story that there's no reason to assume somebody would make up. Halacha is very much afraid of this problem, because we've seen historically that saying to somebody, your husband is dead, and then coming back 2 years later and saying, oops, to err is human, we made a boo-boo, compounds a tragedy with a tragedy, and it produces situations in which people who have already gone through very bad situations go through the ringer a second time and frequently never recover. Based on this, in situations where we think that husbands are dead, we require evidence above and beyond that that we do in many other situations. We really want evidence that's likely enough that the risk of error or mistake is zero. Because we found that situations of error and mistake bring incredible heartache and tragedy to people in a way that can be avoided. So we've developed certain practices. One of the practices we have in the Beth Din of America is when people disappear, the first thing we do is we wait. We wait. And we let the whole world calm down and things sort themselves out. Because two of the cases that came to us, the husbands were subsequently found. One had suffered terrible amnesia and was in a hospital. And he had been in the hospital for 2 weeks before he was discovered. The New York City hospital system was overwhelmed by 9/11, bordering on dysfunctional. Patients were sent anywhere and everywhere, and it was hard to keep track of patients. And this is one of these few situations where they didn't ask you for your health insurance card. They just treated everybody and anybody. And it took weeks sometimes to sort things out. So one of the things you do is you do nothing, and you wait until things calm down. Normally, we waited to write letters unless there was absolute physical evidence until a year had passed, figuring that nobody was in that big of a rush to get married, and waiting a year allowed all sorts of situations to clarify themselves. The second thing is you explain to people that the consequences of error is very great. And thus what you want here is you want a slow process that works with 100% accuracy rather than a fast process that gets you a pretty good result that doesn't work 100% of the time. That's not true for pastrami shilas. When you call up your rabbi and say, I made a pastrami sandwich, but I stuck a dairy knife in the mustard, can I eat it? And the rabbi says, call me back in a year, and I'll answer your question for you. He's failed. Because you're standing there with your pastrami sandwich in front of you, and to say, call me back in a year, is an ineffective... The answer might be right, but the time frame is so wrong that the question it stops being worthwhile asking questions. But what we discovered was that this was not such a question. Frequently, the answer was we would sit and think. Not only would we sit and think, we'd go around building consensuses, making sure that nobody really disagreed with us, because we wanted to make sure that everybody more or less reached the right result, because the consequences of the wrong result was terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy. And by the way, you would say, well, who would do terrible things like this? But all that you need to do to see this is to read some of the literature on 9/11 frauds. After the 9/11 tragedy, there were a half a dozen cases of terrible fraud. People said, oh, you know what this is an opportunity to do?
Disappear.
Make some money. And we took to waiting and watching to make sure that we were not part of the process drove this. So 9/11 Agunot is the first return to the World War II style Agunot that we've had in the United States in more than 50 years.
How many were there?
Well, it depends how you count. We wrote 11 Shuvot. There were 15 hard cases. But by the time the medical examiner had identified body parts, we wrote letters for 100 people. But some of them turned out to be easy because of the policy of waiting. What would happen is the medical examiner would call us up and say, you inquired about Mr. X. We found a chest. So you no longer need to write a letter once there's a body.
Were you only involved with people that they were interested in getting into this?
Yes, of course. But many, many, many people. In general, the pastoral situation involving the burial of a person when there's no body calls for greater halachic conversation. Normally, when a husband dies, the wife doesn't say, I want a letter from a Beis Din that I can remarry, because the proof, so to speak, that she can remarry is the presence of a body, of a dead husband. People don't go around saying, prove to me that your husband was dead. That's a grossly insensitive question. But in situations where people die without a body, the custom is that you do heightened diligence to verify in fact that this person is permitted to remarry. Over time, the medical examiner produced an enormous amount of medical information which would verify body parts and eliminate many, many, many of the hard cases, because he would find a chest or a crushed skull or a torso or a whole leg. All of these made shilas disappear, because once you see enough of a body to know that a person couldn't be dead, then you have a kavura. And once you have a kavura, then you no longer have a genuine aguna question, because you have a body part that actually is proof of a person's death. Please.
Is it possible that there was, let's say, an 85% chance that DNA evidence was the same as a person? Is that possible?
No. DNA evidence, if it's a match, the number is always above 99. How far above 99 it is, and how perfect the match is driven by how clean the DNA is and how many of the alleles you can match. There are 14 points that they customarily match. If they can customarily match all 14 points because the DNA is clean, then the odds of there being an identical match is higher than 1 in a billion. 1 in a billion is a good number. 1 in a billion is a good number. On the other hand, 1 in a billion means that there are 4 other, 5 other, 6 other people in the world who could match. It's not 1 in a trillion, it's 1 in a billion. There are 7 million people. 1 in a billion is still a number. And in dirty DNA, DNA that's not nearly as clean, the number is lower than that. It's sometimes in the 1 in a million, 1 in 100,000, something like that. So it never approaches 85%, but it sometimes is merely 99.9997, which sounds like a very good number. Somebody says to me that you're 99.997% likely to win $1 million, so I'm already spending the money in my mind. But still, statistically, it's far from a sure thing, particularly when you deal with a large population.
You mentioned before the story about the soldier who got kidnapped and who was actually in Lebanon. So in that case, are the children considered Mamzerim?
The woman did not remarry, but the answer is yes.
Even though the rabbi says she can't.
The rabbinic rabbis don't make reality. They only describe the reality. And when they describe the reality incorrectly, then they've described the reality incorrectly, and it's as if they've never spoken. So when a rabbi says to you, your husband is dead, and he's not, then the fact that the rabbi said to you, your husband's dead, doesn't in any mythical sense make him dead. It makes the rabbi mistaken. Sometimes grossly mistaken, sometimes subtly mistaken, but mistaken nonetheless. And there's no license to the second marriage in any way, shape, or form. This is a vast difference between the halachic tradition and many other legal traditions. Rabbis don't make those realities, they just pronounce them.
In one of the essays in the book, there's one of the rabbis describes the methodology. And he says that that one of the methodologies was to come to a conclusion and then use halacha to kind of like prove that conclusion.
Sure.
Is that unique to the Aguna problem?
It's much more common in the Aguna problem in the following sense. You look quickly at the facts and you intuit that the husband is dead. And then you walk the cat backwards, as they say. Meaning, you say, assuming the husband is dead, how can I prove that? And then you go around proving that. That's much easier to do in fact-driven cases than it is in halacha-driven cases. In fact-driven cases, you develop a pretty clear intuition of what happened. And then you try to bring proof along the way to show that that which you think happened is that which really happened. So that's a common methodology in all matters of halacha where the correct result hinges on what actually happened. I'll give you a common case. Husband calls wife and says, I'm on the 92nd floor, the plane's been hit, the tower's been hit, I think I'm going to die, I love you, goodbye. Now that's a very moving conversation, but how do you know the husband was really there? Maybe he was in Bensonhurst with his girlfriends. So you know what you do? You start proving data points. What's the first thing you do? Find out what did he call from, and the answer is he called from a cell phone. And then you ask the following question: well, tell me, can you identify the cell tower that transmitted the call? There's only one cell tower transmitting cell calls up and down the World Trade Center. So you begin to be able to identify not only cell tower conversations, but
do you need to? That's a question.
Sure. Let me answer as follows. More facts that prove the right result is always better. And then you say, well, the phone call was made from the cell tower in the World Trade Center. And then, you know what they told to us? Well, actually, the receptor for cell phone towers runs up and down the World Trade Center. And we can tell you what receptor took the call, telling you how high up he was on the World Trade Tower. So we said, oh, that's really interesting information. Tell us what cell tower, what exact cell was the call made from. And the answer is this one was made from the top floor. So you walk the cat backwards all the time to determine facts when you have an intuition. Sometimes, by the way, you find bumps. The facts don't quite match up with what you think it's supposed to be. And then you have to stop and re-examine to figure out what's really going on.
In the case of 9/11, it seems like Beijing was even more stringent than the state in declaring people dead, I assume. But were there any other cases when it's the opposite, when the state
because it says they may still be alive, but the Beijing would...
Sure. Look, the United States has a very liberal death definition. That's been the custom since after World War II. And there's a very complicated question about social policy in the United States. In general, in the United States, if you disappear for an extended period of time, the United States government declares you dead, whether or not they have any firm evidence of your death. I don't want to stop to critique why exactly the United States government does this and why they do it. They have a good reason for doing it, but they know that there are error rates. Error rates to us are exceptionally problematic and not something we want to have in any way, shape, or form.
Are there cases of the opposite in 9/11?
No. In general, in the United, the Beijing is stricter in the sense that we want actual physical evidence of death at a higher level than that which is required by secular law. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I have heard much about the yeshiva and the strict atmosphere they can feel. Rav Moshe's insight about Rav Elazar Verdun is a very fascinating.